a much more compulsive, detailed, precise, careful approach to things, instead of a more global approach. So he comes across as a person who is quite organized and compulsive. He tends to avoid emotion, to deny and repress his feelings. He's quite organized and quite compulsive in his approach to problems, very systematic and detailed. And that helps a lot if you're the sort of person who wants to compartmentalize everything and put one feeling here and one feeling there. He can do it in a very efficient, organized, systematic way. As a result, things don't overwhelm him. They don't interfere with his function. He's able to function, really, quite effectively, particularly by choosing a profession that enables him to be a strong authority figure and that helps him escape from emotional responsibilities. He becomes a physician. Better yet, he becomes a surgeon, because a surgeon doesn't have to interact emotionally with people. He's God. He is the authority. Nobody questions him. In fact, he doesn't even have to talk to patients, because they're under anesthesia during the whole procedure. I suspect if you brought in and examined a whole slew of surgeons, you would find most of them having emotional adjustments very much like Captain McDonald's. What I'm trying to get across is that these characteristics in his personality are neither uncommon nor maladaptive for many purposes. They just don't make him into a very affectionate, warm, loving spouse. But there are a lot of people out in the world that are not affectionate, warm, loving spouses. In terms of his life history, however, and in keeping with his need to conform, as well as his need to be emotionally dependent on people, even though outwardly he doesn't acknowledge this, he married quite young, and he married under circumstances where it wasn't altogether clear that many people would have married. He married young and set up a family and went through, in a way, still carrying on with the image of the golden boy. But his marriage was not a combination of two terribly mature or adequate individuals. It was, rather, a relationship where he would have the support and approval of his wife, while he failed to become involved with her in an emotionally close or mutually cooperative relationship. In many ways, he resented and avoided the demands and responsibilities of being a father, and he was able to use his academic and professional career as a reasonably acceptable excuse to avoid involvement. You know, how can a wife complain that he's not spending enough time around the house when he's getting a medical degree, working hard to support the family, and buying presents and giving things to everybody? So, what does the wife say? Well, the wife is saying things like, you know, couldn't you just be around the house a little more? Give us a little more love and affection? A little more of your time? It's hard to just say no. Instead, what you say is, I've got to work. You know, I've got to do all these things. I'm doing this for you. So he chose a profession that took care of his time, and in a sense, took care of his responsibilities, because it limited the extent to which he would have to emotionally and maturely communicate more effectively in the family situation. I hope there aren't too many doctors in the audience here. It works quite nicely, I might add. But in those situations, such as with the family, where there was less structure, he ran into problems, where he couldn't clearly be either the one on the bottom or the one on the top. There he gets into difficulty. Wanting the approval of society, and not wanting to do anything to disrupt a situation that was, in the outside world's eyes, very successful, a doctor, married, settled, children, he was caught in a dilemma. He was caught up in something that on his own, he was not strong and assertive and aggressive enough to find his way out of, either by achieving a closer relationship with his wife or by getting a divorce. And he couldn't communicate openly about these feelings, either with himself or with his wife, because he was so caught up in this stern, authoritarian image of himself. Look at this picture. It's sort of a 1930-ish picture of a man and a woman, and the man is sort of turned off to the side, looking away, and the woman has her arms around him. People often see that the woman is pleading with the man in some way. Okay, now here's his story. I'm trying to make out the expression on his face. This is a husband and wife. The husband feels strongly about something, and the wife is obviously showing pride and concern over her husband's anger and is trying to console him. I mean, the husband is an angry, striving, aggressive, assertive beast, and that makes the woman feel good. He goes on, he enjoys that she is responding so nicely to his show of concern. He'll be able to control his feelings through her urgings. They'll both feel fine. She showed her concern in love, and he gave in to her wishes in calming down. I suspect the inciting cause was an advance made to her by the milkman, or a slight to her by her boss. So he was going to protect her, or keep other people away. She's calming him, but she really appreciates a show of affection. So, he is the sort of stern, taciturn, demanding, authoritarian figure, and she is pleading, "Don't do it. I know you're protecting me, but calm yourself," urging him to be happy and successful as a husband. But there's no real communication about his feelings or thoughts or ideas going on here. People are behaving according to images. In many ways, a person of his conformity might achieve a great deal through close relationships with older male figures. But he fears emotional closeness with males due to his fears of homosexual impulses in himself. Now, actually, he doesn't have any real, strong homosexual impulses, but he's afraid that he might. He has a fear of the possibility that these things might exist, and thus he's turned off from close relationships with males. Let me give you another example from the TAT. In this picture, one person is lying down and another is standing over them, bent, with the hand out. The person standing is usually seen as male. The person lying down, it's really sort of obscure, but probably it's more commonly seen as male. He says, "This is an old man and a boy. They're both hobo types, traveling together. The old man has been traveling with the young man as a friend for the last 2 days, through Texas. The old man looks at the boy and thinks of his own son, and on this night he felt a sudden urge of affection and fatherly-type feeling for the boy while he's sleeping. He wanted to reach over and touch the boy, his shoulder or his hair. The boy is going to wake up and misunderstand and run away and break up a nice friendship. His misunderstanding prevented a lasting friendship from developing, the old man being much more hurt than the boy." Now, said the psychologist, having no awareness of Jeffrey McDonald's sudden departure for Texas at the age of 15 and his automobile trip from New York in the company of Jack Andrews Sr., "in a sense here, I think that Captain McDonald is identifying with both figures. He's the young boy who is afraid of the relationship with the older figure, but he's also the older figure who can't communicate his feelings to the boy. And there is really sort of a bittersweet quality about these feelings that he simply doesn't know how to express or accept. He has in himself a longing and a need for these things, but no idea of how to get at them or how to communicate about them, so he stays isolated. An important element, you see, in his concept of the masculine role is that a man does not show emotion or weakness. To ask for help or understanding is a sign of inadequacy. Thus, his confident manner, which initially gives the impression of strength, is, in fact, a rather rigid defense, which doesn't permit him to become close to other people and doesn't allow him to ask for support even when it would be appropriate. If he were to bring his feelings out more consciously and openly, then all his conflicts about adequacy versus need for support would come out in the open, too, and make him much more anxious and upset and depressed. He can't tolerate that. So all these things are kept sealed over. I'm bringing them out from some of the test results, but that doesn't mean he's consciously aware of them. Now, when a person is concerned about their adequacy, about how successful they are, and that person happens to be an American man, one of the ways that this gets expressed is in terms of heterosexual behavior. How do they make it with women? And obviously, this is going to come up with Captain McDonald. But the problem is, he is confronted with not only his image of himself as a very adequate male, but his need to be socially conforming and get acceptance and approval. So what does he do? He has a whole series of affairs with women, but never with a lot of satisfaction or success. And he is always overcome afterwards, not by any deep, internalized sense of guilt, but a sort of a feeling of shame. The difference that you might see in a young kid who has done something wrong and is caught by their parent and feels ashamed and blushes and turns red, as opposed to the idea of guilt, where somebody does something wrong, they know it is wrong, and internally they're bothered by it. It doesn't matter that nobody knows about it. Internally, they've got a sense of guilt. His behavior was more motivated out of this sort of shame, because he was concerned about the approval of others. So, although to listen to him, he might present himself as sort of a stud, a very successful male in having sexual encounters, in fact, he really is not. He's not comfortable with himself in this image, so he's not free to go out and be consistently sexually aggressive. You know, a person who is completely liberated in this sense, although he might not approve of it, a person who is completely liberated in this sense might perfectly well be able to go out and have affairs, and if the wife brought up any objection, you'd just say, "If you don't like it, leave me. You know, this is your problem. This is the way I run my life." Okay, he couldn't do that at all. Another person might be so bothered by guilt over having an affair that he might stop and not have any more. That would be another way of handling it. Instead, he had affairs but was never completely happy in having them, and yet he couldn't completely stop them. So there was this sort of continually wanting the approval and affection and love of the women, but also wanting the approval and affection and love of society. The fact is, he has a sort of unusual combination of defenses. Unusual, in the sense that psychologists like to type people into nice, neat little compartments. And that's great when we write textbooks. But unfortunately, when we meet with a real person, they don't fit into such nice, neat compartments. He has this funny combination of, on one hand, an obsessive approach, an intellectualizing approach. That's a fairly unusual combination of defenses, and I think it makes him particularly difficult to understand. Now, what does all this have to do with the actual crime that occurred? On the basis of a psychological examination, I don't think a psychologist can determine if a person is lying or not. I think I can, with relative certainty, describe his adjustment, describe what he was like, account for why he is reacting to what happened the way he did, but as to whether he could be lying about a specific detail or not, I can't read his mind. And I think in general it's very difficult to say who, and under what circumstances, can commit a murder. Give me a group of 100 people, and let me examine the group, and I might predict out of that 100 what proportion might be likely to commit violent behavior. But you give me one person, and ask me to predict, and boy, I'm not going to make any money. I'd rather bet on the horses. So from my understanding of Captain MacDonald's adjustment, the two questions I would want to ask myself are, one, what sort of circumstances would be maximally stressful for him and might lead him to commit a violent crime? And two, if he committed a violent crime, how would he go about it and how would he respond to it? Now, on the basis of his adjustment, it is my feeling that the most stressful type of circumstance would be one where a person not in authority over him and not under him, but a person he hasn't clearly got a structured role with, like a wife or a peer, would say something that would directly challenge his basic area of conflict, his sense of adequacy and masculine autonomy. So a taunt from his wife, suggesting that he lacked confidence or he lacked virility, I think, would perhaps be the most upsetting thing to him, the thing that might lead him to become most angry, most likely to commit a violent act. I cannot think of a basis that would provide sufficient stress for him to commit a violent act against someone who was not in this, clearly, unstructured role to him. In other words, people way in authority over him, he would have no trouble submitting. That was his style of life. People way in authority under him, they're clearly under him. They wouldn't provide as much stress. Therefore, based on my knowledge of him, I could not conceive of emotionally stressful circumstances that would be such that it would lead him to kill his children. But I could think of some that might lead him to be angry enough to do something to his wife. I have seen murderers who were essentially cold-blooded, psychopathic killers, who killed without any particular concern for what they've done and maintained a perfect calm. Not because they were defending against anything, but just because they didn't care and coldly and calculatedly went about their business and afterwards tried to handle and conceal evidence and save themselves. And I've seen people who have committed a murder in the midst of a psychotic episode. And I've seen people who were basically rather passive, dependent individuals that held their feelings inside of them, with adjustments like Captain McDonald's, and like probably some of you, who have indeed committed a murder. Usually the murder is of a spouse. The great majority of murders are the murders of spouses. But the way this sort of individual typically responds is immediately afterwards, they break down. They frequently become amnesic for the whole event and pick up the phone and calmly say, "I don't know what's happened. There's a knife in my hand. I think my wife or husband is dead. You'd better come quick and bring the police." And you come in and the children are sitting there crying and there's just one big mess. And then you go to interview them and they say, "I don't know what happened." They have blocked it completely from their minds. One study done in England estimated that in approximately 60% of the murders they studied, the person who was accused was amnesic for the event. Now, Dr. McDonald is a person who does repress and deny and compartmentalize. And it's my feeling that were he to have committed such a crime, his response afterwards would most likely be that type of response. "Can you generalize," Victor Warheide asked, "about how long such an amnesic episode might last?" "Sometimes they last indefinitely. Most of them persist for some time. It depends on the way you handle them, and of course, it's always confused because some people that are apparently amnesic are actually concealing details of the crime. Incidentally, I want to make clear that when I use the words denial and repression, I do not mean a conscious attempt to, like, say, 'Oh, I'm not going to tell this.' It means that it is completely blocked out of the conscious mind, that the person does not have that information available to himself. And I am saying that in this case, it is quite likely that had Captain McDonald committed such a violent crime, he would have completely blocked the whole episode from his mind. In other words, he would not know how it happened, and he would have run around trying to be the doctor and save everybody. But is it also likely, Warheide asked, that if he did block it out, let's say temporarily, that he might some moments afterwards become aware of the fact that there were dead people in the house and he is involved in their deaths, and being aware of that and being a highly intelligent man with quick responses and being mindful from conversations he had in the recent past concerning the Sharon Tate case in a magazine article that was in his house, that he might be capable of creating a scene that might have some semblance of a similar crime being committed in his house by certain unknown intruders?" "No, it doesn't make sense to me that if he had blocked it out of his mind by the unconscious motives we are talking about, that he would then, having blocked it out, think, 'Oh, I must have blocked it out unconsciously, and really I've done it, and therefore I've got to conceal the evidence.' Usually people's minds don't work that way. I mean, that would be pretty strange, to act upon the basis of something you're not consciously aware of, and then go ahead and try to conceal it. Also, in regard to what had happened to him, he was by no means totally unaware of the loss that he suffered, even though he was emotionally constricted in his expression of his sense of loss. He had begun, in talking with me, to verbalize some awareness of how little he had communicated his feelings to his wife and family. And furthermore, he began to verbalize some of the feelings that he had had of feeling trapped in marriage and caught up in responsibilities he had assumed. And he was aware of the ironic quality that something that had happened, the loss of his wife and family, had both made him realize how little he had communicated to them of his feelings, and at the same time gave him a sense of shame, because he was aware in some sense that what happened provided him with relief. And the most ironic aspect of all, from his point of view, was that his life was saved and his family was killed, from his expression of it, because he had failed to react aggressively. If he had been the man that he thought he was, the whole thing wouldn't have happened. The fact that he was alive was due to the fact that he was not the man he says he is. If he had been what he says he was, he would be dead, because he would have withstood them and either chased them away or been killed himself. "Do I understand you to say," Victor Warheide asked, "that with the death of his wife and children, there was a sense of, let's say, release, a sense of liberation, a sense of relief?" "Yes. That was part of his reaction to what had happened. I might add that the fact that he could reveal this to me was one of the things that impressed me with his relative sincerity and frankness." When the psychologist resumed the stand after lunch, Victor Warheide said to him, "The man you examined, Dr. McDonald, testified for a period of 5 days before this grand jury. I want to outline some of the things that came out during his testimony and ask you how they fit within the framework of your conclusions with respect to his personality adjustment. During the Article 32 proceeding and prior thereto, and for a period of time thereafter, Dr. McDonald received very strong support from his in-laws, Colette's mother and stepfather, people by the name of Kassab. At the conclusion of the Article 32 proceeding, McDonald made a number of statements to the press. He also appeared on TV. Among other things, he said he was going to conduct an independent investigation because he was not satisfied with the job the Army had done. They were bunglers and incompetents. He was going to find the people who committed this offense, and he was going to get revenge. Later, in a telephone conversation with his father-in-law, he stated in substance, "I've been conducting my investigation in the bars and hippie hangouts of Fayetteville. I have found one of the persons who was an intruder into my home. I took him out. I, in effect, beat him up. When I was through with him, he would have told on his own mother. Then I killed him. He's 6 foot under." When McDonald testified, he said, "Yes, I did tell this story to Kassab. On subsequent occasions, extending for a period of over a year, he wrote letters to the Kassabs saying that he was pursuing the investigation further. He already had gotten one of them. He still had at least three to go. He was making transcontinental trips. He broke his arm. It cost him $4,000. Then, when he testified before the grand jury, he said, "Yes, it's true. I wrote these letters. I had this telephone conversation. I said these things to Kassab. I used these terms. It was all a lie. But I was forced to do it. I was forced to do it by Kassab, by his pressing me to go forward." Now, how does this fit into your analysis of Dr. McDonald as a man? "I can answer some of that," the psychologist said. "I can't answer all of it. It would not be at all surprising for him to respond to what had happened with quick, impulsive, angry, vindictive outbursts like, 'Those idiots, those imbeciles, those nincompoops.' And he might do this without thinking of the consequences for himself. In a way, if I were an attorney, I would hate to defend a guy like this because I would never be sure but what the minute he got out of my sight, he was going to do something on his own that blows the whole defense, because he was convinced that, by God, he knew what to do, and he knew it was the right thing. He's a very opinionated guy, so that's perfectly consistent. He's right and everybody else is an idiot. That's him all over. It might also be perfectly consistent for him to say, 'I'll get revenge. I'll work this out. Those guys don't know how to do it. I can solve this.' But it would be very inconsistent for him to in fact conduct an investigation over the next couple of years and do it. I would expect he would make the quick, impulsive outburst and then quickly seal over all his feelings and go on to something else. But would he lie about it? Or Heidi asked. And lie about it to the extent of saying, I found one of them, I tortured him, I killed him. That certainly sounds like a strange sort of lie to make up. I'd have to look at it from this point of view. What would be the sort of thing that could make a person like Captain MacDonald lie? If he perceived he was being forced into something by somebody that he had respect for, and he saw as a stronger authority figure, he might go along superficially with things. In other words, I don't know his relationship with his father-in-law, but if his father-in-law was perceived as a strong, secure authority figure, it might be that Captain MacDonald might have lied to go along with that, even though he himself was trying to put these things out of his mind and go about his business in his bland, denying way. That might provide some of the motivation. That is a rather grisly story to make up, however, and my explanation doesn't really do it justice. That's just one thing that comes to mind. Another is that MacDonald is a guy who likes to be right. He wants to be the authority himself, and it may be that if somebody were bugging him and trying to tell him that he wasn't doing the right thing, conceivably that might provide a motivation, where he in effect might just be saying, "Get off, buddy," telling him where to get off by making up something bizarre. For example, on some of the tests he did with me, he would occasionally make a remark interspersed in the test that really was sort of putting me down. You know, he would say, "I guess that sounds a little hysterical," or, "I see this area as a breast, but I'm a breast man. That's the reason I see breasts. I know you psychologists make a lot of things out of this," which was sort of saying, "I understand everything that you do, and it's a bunch of nonsense." "All right," Warheide said. He gave an extensive interview to a newspaper reporter. This was taped and was published in serialized form over a period of days, setting forth verbatim questions and answers. When asked about this, he said he really didn't want to do it, but he was forced to do it. He was compelled to do it by his lawyers. "That may be the truth," the psychologist replied, "but regardless of what his lawyers told him, it's certainly true that Captain MacDonald would have gotten quite a charge out of trying to make the army look stupid. To show that he was right and they were wrong, he would get a lot of enjoyment out of that, no question in my mind." Now, after the Article 32, he appeared on the Dick Cavett Show. He was on Walter Cronkite's news program, and he gave a number of interviews. He called his sister, who lived out of town, and asked her to get everybody they knew to tune in the Dick Cavett Show on the night he appeared. When asked about it here, he said, "Well, I really didn't want to. I was forced to do it. This was because certain congressmen and Kassab were pushing me. I had to do it because they made me." My inclination, again, I think, is that probably he would get a great deal of enjoyment out of doing that. This is another example of his tendency to do things regardless of the effect on him, when he thinks he is right. In other words, if a person wanted to act in the manner most helpful to himself, having gone through the Article 32 proceedings as he did, it seems to me there would be a couple of options. One, you might really have a firm, idealistic belief that you had been mistreated by the army and that there's something wrong with the whole system, and you're going to set out in a sort of messianic way to change the system. I don't see MacDonald as having that type of motivation. I don't think he is the type that would maintain a long-term, idealistic-oriented campaign. I think he is too much concerned with his own gratification and sealing all of this over and getting out of it. Now, if you were going to be mature and responsible about this, and you were not so oriented, your next step would probably be to think, "I'm out of this. By God, I'm going to get as far away from this and lay as low as possible." You know, not to stir up the hornet's nest again. Well, here's an example, I think, where instead of behaving in his own best interests, he impulsively sounded off in a way that was neither dedicated towards idealistically reforming the situation, nor towards keeping attention away from himself and letting things calm down. It is simply an index of his self-righteousness and his need to appear strong and assertive that would lead him to do things that actually work against him. You know, I can't think of anything better calculated to get the army or somebody else back down on his back again, trying to hurt him. Just one final point, Doctor. His current lifestyle apparently involves working in an emergency room on the West Coast. He has a very nice apartment. He associates with attractive people, attractive girlfriends. He has an expensive sports car. He has a large boat. And he apparently is leading a lifestyle entirely different from the kind of life he had when he was married. Do you have any comment? It strikes me, the psychologist said, that the style of life you're describing is perhaps one of the few viable alternatives left for him, given his adjustment. That is to say, Captain MacDonald wanted to go into a residency in surgery. In view of what he went through, it seems to me very unlikely that he could be accepted for a residency in surgery. So his professional goals, the thing he had planned for a long time, were undoubtedly quite upset. Now, there are some people who would react to that in one way, and others who would react in another. Again, from what I've said about Captain MacDonald, I would expect him to react to that by denying that it was an upsetting thing. To quickly reconstitute his defenses and set up a life where he was perfectly happy, content, relaxed, and appeared to be an adequate, competent man. What's available to him? To retreat to the golden boy style of life he led in school? Now, you can't be a golden boy by getting good grades or that sort of thing when you're not in school. But you can live in an open, relaxed, Southern California style. Nice cars, women. That doesn't surprise me. It seems to me that's quite consistent with the way he might be expected to react to it. And by being a single swinger, I don't think he would be a terribly effective swinger, by the way. Ostensibly, the swinger, let's say. Yes, I think, again, it's quite superficial. But without a wife who would make demands on him? Right. And without children who would make demands? Exactly. I think, in fact, it's probably a very adaptive response for him. He's probably a lot better off living that style of life for the time being than trying to get married again. When Freddie Kassab was called to testify, he said, "Jeff was a nice boy from all I ever saw. He used to come over on the weekends and cut the lawn. When he and Colette started going again, Mildred and I were very pleased. We liked Jeff. When Colette told us she was pregnant and that they wanted to get married, we tried to talk her out of it, only because Jeff was going to medical school and she had only put in 2 years of college. But when Mrs. MacDonald came in and talked to us, we said, 'We don't have anything against it. They should go ahead and get married if that's what they want,' which they did. My belief in his innocence was based on the fact that I knew the boy. However, I knew nothing about what occurred that night, nor did my wife. Nobody told us a thing. We were just going on the assumption that how could a man such as we knew do such a thing to his wife and baby children? And of course, the worst thing of all, in a way, was to turn around and write in blood on the headboard of the bed. This is something that is just inconceivable. But when you sit down with the facts and you analyze them, and you see that his whole story is a fabrication, you are left with only one conclusion. We knew prior to this of what we considered a failing he had, but we didn't put too much stock in it. But the fact is that Jeff has complete disdain for anyone and everyone that I have ever known him to know. He has contempt for everybody. Out of their sight, though. His disdain is not in their presence. In other words, the minute somebody walked out the door, that's who he talked about. Jeff had a habit of doing this at all times. He is mentally, in his mind, superior to most people. This, you know, was the only thing we ever knew about him that we didn't care for. But what the heck, you know, we've all got our faults, so we just overlooked this. But he would never criticize anybody to their face. He never had the guts to do it. He never fought me to my face. He never came back when I started accusing him of all this stuff and confronted me with anything. Never. Never. And he knew about it, because I got to the point where I sat his mother down in my kitchen after he moved to California, and I said, "I think there are a few things you ought to know." So he knew about my thoughts. But he never called me and said, "What's this all about?" He just wrote me a couple of letters and said, "You know, I'm out here doing fairly good." Toward the end of his testimony, when asked if he had any theories about what might have precipitated the murders, Kassab said, "That area is a dark area. Something happened that caused an argument. I believe that it was an instantaneous thing. He may have socked her and she may have picked up the hairbrush and hit him back, and that just sent him into a blind fury to be hit by a woman. But nobody will ever know, because I assure you, Jeff McDonald will never tell you." There was, however, one person who was willing to try to fit together the pieces of the puzzle. Paul Stambaugh, chief of the chemistry section of the FBI laboratory, who had first been shown evidence pertaining to the McDonald case in 1971. In the summer of 1974, Victor Warheide and Brian Murtaugh had again presented Stambaugh with the physical evidence collected at the scene and had asked for a more exhaustive analysis. Having obtained permission from Freddie Kassab, who had legal title to the cemetery plots in which Colette and Kimberly and Kristen McDonald were buried, they had also asked Stambaugh to supervise exhumation and take hair samples from the head of each body. Having done so, and having made microscopic examinations, Stambaugh determined conclusively that the blonde hair found in the palm of Colette McDonald's hand had, without question, been her own, and not that of a blonde intruder. Toward the end of the grand jury hearing, it was by now, in fact, January 15, 1975, Paul Stambaugh was summoned to Raleigh to report on his laboratory findings. He first summarized the results of his 1971 analysis. That there were 48 puncture holes in Jeffrey McDonald's blue pajama top that could have been made by the ice pick that had been found outside the house. Further, that the holes had been made when the top was stationary. None had the tearing at the edges which would have resulted from their having been made while the garment was in motion. Similar ice pick holes in Colette McDonald's pink pajama top had been made while that garment was stationary. That some of Colette McDonald's blood had stained the pajama top before it was torn. That the cuts in all garments other than the blue pajama top had been made by the old hickory knife, despite the fact that it was the Geneva Forge knife McDonald had said he'd pulled from his wife's chest. Stambaugh then described the results of the more extensive analysis, which he had just completed. He had discovered, he said, that certain of the bloodstains on the Hilton Hotel bath mat found on Colette's abdomen matched outlines of the old hickory paring knife and of the ice pick, indicating that those two weapons, while bloody, had been laid temporarily, and perhaps even wiped, on that bath mat. He had discovered also, he said, that certain of the bloodstains from the sheet found rumpled on the master bedroom floor matched the sleeves of Colette's pajama top, and that still others seemed to have been made by a pair of hands and by the bare left shoulder of an adult human being. The implication, Stambaugh said, the inescapable implication, was that someone wearing Jeffrey McDonald's blue pajama top, which had already been stained by Colette's blood, had covered Colette's body with that sheet and then had picked up her body and carried it. Stambaugh stepped down from the witness stand and stepped to a slide projector. The room was darkened. A slide was displayed on a screen in garish, awful color. "Now this is Kristen's room," Stambaugh said, his voice perfectly even and controlled. "And I'd like to direct your attention to this area right here. This is the top sheet on that bed, and it has a huge blood stain on it. Yet there is no blood stain underneath, on the bottom sheet." In reading the reports, it was reflected that the huge blood stain on the top sheet in Kristen's room was type A blood, is Colette's blood type. Kristen had type O blood, and the rest of the blood in that room, the bulk of it, was type O. Now, in examining this stain, it was not one that would have been put there just by somebody's hand. It's a huge stain, as you can see. An awful lot of blood flowed there. The only way you get staining such as this is from a steady flow right down onto it. The lights came on. Stambaugh returned to the witness stand and the multicolored bedspread, which also had been found rumpled on the master bedroom floor, was laid out before the grand jurors. At one time, Stambaugh said, this had a very heavy flow of blood from a type A person directly onto it. In fact, even today, there's a large cake of blood on this, a specimen of type A blood. Now, if this bedspread had been placed down on the floor of Kristen's room, and Colette's body were lifted off the bed where she was bleeding, she would have bled directly on the spread. Then her body could have been covered with this sheet, and as the person lifted it up, he stepped on the blood in this bedspread. The spread, you see, is very heavy, and blood does not soak through it. It acts like a bit of a well in there and holds it. If he stepped in that and carried Colette's body out of this room, he would leave a bloody footprint. There was a short silence in the grand jury room as this image lingered in the mind. Then Victor Warheide said, in addition, you looked at Kristen's bedspread, didn't you? Yes, sir, I did. That bedspread, it's been testified to, had marks of blood on it that were in the blood type of Kimberly. It's also been testified that there is Kimberly's blood type, type AB, on the club. Can you offer a possible explanation of how the AB blood might have gotten on that bedspread? Yes. This stain is not a result of direct bleeding. It's been a transfer of blood. In other words, a very bloody object having AB blood on it was placed here. It could have occurred by resting the club in a bloody condition on the bedspread. All right, Victor Warheide said. Now, from your observations and the evidence that you studied, is it reasonable to say that there was a struggle involving a person wearing the blue pajama top in the master bedroom, at which time the blue pajama top was torn? And is it reasonable to say that Colette MacDonald, having suffered an injury and bleeding, was in a position on the bed of Kristen MacDonald, over near the wall, where she bled directly on the top sheet of Kristen MacDonald's bed? Yes, sir. And I'd like to point out one other thing in that regard. If I can have the pajama bottoms? Victor Warheide removed Colette MacDonald's pajama bottoms from a plastic bag and handed them to Paul Stambaugh, who displayed them to the grand jury. The only injuries Colette MacDonald suffered, he said, were from her waist up. She had no injuries from her waist down. Now, what puzzled me was how her pajama bottoms, the front of them, got so much blood down on the legs. And according to the laboratory report, this is all type A blood, her own blood. It's direct bleeding, and it's a lot of bleeding. And we have two places where we find this type of thing. One is the top sheet of Kristen's bed, and one is on these. This would indicate to me, due to the fact that this bed is only 36 inches wide, that Colette MacDonald was probably knocked across the bed, up against the wall, and fell forward, causing the blood to drip down onto the top sheet and onto the pajama bottoms. Stambaugh moved on to the next order of business, removing a large photograph from an envelope. This, he said, was a photograph taken at the time of autopsy, and it shows the damage to Colette MacDonald's chest. If you'll notice, I guess the people in the back can't see too well, we have 21 ice pick wounds. According to the autopsy report, she suffered 21 ice pick wounds to the chest. They were deep and penetrating. In studying the wounds, we see a group of 5 in her right chest and a group of 16 in her left chest area. Now, in studying the pictures of Colette as she was found on the floor, we see that she has this blue pajama top draped over her. In refolding Jeffrey MacDonald's pajama top exactly as it appeared in the crime scene photographs, Stambaugh said, it was observed that the 48 ice pick holes in it could have been made by 21 thrusts of an ice pick, and that those 21 thrusts seemed to be in alignment with the 21 ice pick holes in Colette MacDonald's chest, 16 on one side and 5 on the other, indicating strongly that she had been stabbed with the ice pick after the blue pajama top had been laid across her chest. Now, we can't say positively this happened, Stambaugh said. We're pointing out this is a possibility. It could have happened. because all the holes are accounted for, and we did come up with the same number and the same locations. Now, Mr. Stambaugh, Warheide said, on the basis of your analysis of the physical evidence that you have referred to here today, have you developed any theory of how all these things fit together? What happened that night? Some events, Stambaugh said, I guess we'll never know. But it would appear to me that the fight started in the master bedroom. I believe Dr. MacDonald probably struck his wife in the face with a fist, knocked her down. This would cause the blood to start flowing. She probably had a bloody nose, and through a struggle there, this is where her blood got onto his pajama top before it was torn. Kimberly might have awakened due to the screaming and come up and tried to help her mother. He might have pushed her aside and, this is just supposition on my part, but I feel probably this club, I imagine it could have been kept in the utility room, which is a very short distance from this bedroom. I sort of suspect, possibly, Colette might have picked this club up and socked Jeffrey with it, which could account for the bump on his head. He was a bruiser, so he took the club away from her and went to swing at her, and probably, accidentally or on purpose, struck Kimberly on the side of the head with it, causing her to bleed. And this would account for the AB blood found near the entrance to the room. In the doorway here, in the rug, it had soaked through pretty much, indicating someone had lain here bleeding a good bit. When he did that, I think our little bent knife comes into play, because this is the type of knife that's very dull, and the type a lot of people, including myself, keep around for painting, because it makes a good thing to scrape paint with when you drop some on the floor. I think this was near the club in the utility room, and I think Colette grabbed it and attacked Jeff with this thing, possibly causing the little cut in his left abdomen. That cut was slight and was made with a tearing action. A knife such as this would do that. And when she did that, he leveled her with this club. Then things, I think, sort of quieted down, because I believe Colette undoubtedly had to have been unconscious at that time. I think he picked Kim up, carried her into her bed, and due to the AB blood spatters on the wall, I believe he hit her again with the club and killed her. While this was going on, or possibly before that, I think Colette came too, came into Kristen's room to protect the only child that is not dead, and he caught up with her in there and really let her have it with the club again. This possibly is where both her arms were broken, because they're defense wounds, and she was knocked across to the wall, and we know that she was here at some time in order to have bled this much here. I guess he kind of got himself oriented, picked up the bedspread and the blue sheet from the master bedroom, and carried them back into Kristen's room, reached over, and picked up Colette. Now at this time, his pajama top had been torn, but it probably wasn't too bloody, and I believe all the blood that's on the pajama top, the bulk of it, got on there when he reached across the bed and picked her up and put her down on this bedspread. Then he covered her with this sheet, and, having blood on him, fresh blood, wet blood, and also on his hands, he reached down, picked her up, carried her back into the master bedroom, where she eventually was found. After that, he probably went to the kitchen, and he could have been bleeding by this time from the cut in his abdomen, and he got the rubber gloves and picked up the old hickory knife, and went back in and did the job on the rest of them, and ended up with the ice pick on Colette. I think when he put her body down is when he took his pajama top off and threw it across her body. Then, I believe, he put the bath mat down next to her and put each weapon down on the bath mat as he was finished using it. And then as he left, he put the bath mat on her body and went out the back door and threw the knife and ice pick out. In regard to some of the specifics, Victor Warheide said, all we can do is speculate, and, he said to members of the grand jury, some of whom had begun to embellish or expand upon Stambaugh's theory, your guess is as good or better than mine. But it seems to me there's no question there was a struggle. I do think that Colette, she was a healthy woman and not a weakling, and I think Colette did attempt to defend herself. I think it's consistent with her defending herself that she would pick up the club and swing it at him and hit him on the forehead with it. Not the sort of blow that was strong enough to break the skin or anything, but to raise a lump. At some point, I do think that Colette, in defending herself, did inflict some injury on him, and it seems to me the ones that are most likely to have been inflicted by Colette are the bruise on the forehead and the cut in the abdomen. As to the other wounds, I think that they are most likely to be self-inflicted. All we can do at this juncture is speculate as to some of the details. But the circumstances, it seems to me, lead to the inevitable conclusion that there was a struggle, that the struggle involved a man wearing that pajama top, and that serious injuries were inflicted on Colette and the girls, and Colette ended up bleeding very heavily in Kristen's room, and the club was swung there, and the club was swung in Kimberly's room, and somebody wearing those pajama tops and carrying Colette, whose pajamas had blood on them that was transferred to the sheet, carried her out of that room and made that footprint. And you have heard testimony saying that that's the footprint of Captain MacDonald. Did his pajama top match his pajama bottoms? A grand juror asked. We don't have the bottoms of his pajamas, Warheide said. They were thrown away in the hospital and were burned. But if we did have the bottoms, I think I can predict, and I feel very confident, and I think Mr. Stambaugh would agree with this, that you'd find a lot of type O blood on the bottoms. You see, Kristen was stabbed in her front, and she was stabbed in her back. And she was stabbed very deeply, both front and back. And her body was down over the edge of the bed, and there's a pool of her blood on the floor. And I think he sat on the bed, and he had her on his lap, across his lap, while he was stabbing her. Dr. Robert Sadoff, the psychiatrist who had examined Jeffrey MacDonald in Philadelphia in the spring of 1970, and who had testified at the Article 32 hearing that he was incapable of having committed such a crime, was the last psychiatrist to be interviewed by Warheide. Now, 4.5 years later, he did not seem nearly so certain of his opinion. In preparation for the interview, Warheide had been provided with a copy of a report Dr. Sadoff had delivered to Bernie Siegel in 1970. Inadvertently, however, an original raw report, not the modified edited version, had been delivered. In this initial report, the psychiatrist had referred to a polygraph test, which had apparently been administered to MacDonald, with surprisingly unfavorable results. There must be some distortion in the polygraph test, Dr. Sadoff had reported to Siegel. This was the first item about which Warheide asked Dr. Sadoff. As I recall now, the psychiatrist said, there was a polygraph test. And frankly, it looked as though he did not do well on the test, or the test results were equivocal. My recollection is that it was equivocal, and not as I would have expected it to be, that he would have passed with flying colors. Knowing that polygraph evidence, in any event, would not be admissible in court, Warheide did not pursue the matter further. In arriving at your conclusions in regard to Dr. MacDonald's capacity to commit this crime, he said instead, I take it you relied on what Dr. MacDonald had told you personally? Yes. You accepted his story at face value. You didn't question the veracity of any of the details that he recounted to you. Now, had you been furnished with additional information, which information, let's say, was scientifically reliable and refuted what Dr. MacDonald had told you, do you think it would have caused you to modify your conclusions? To the extent that I would have felt compelled to re-examine Dr. MacDonald and confront him with the evidence that I had and the story that he told me and find out why they were different, based on what I found out from that confrontation, I would assume that I could have changed my conclusions, yes. Warheide then presented to Dr. Sadoff a summary of the testimony of Paul Stambaugh before the grand jury. The 48 ice pick holes in MacDonald's pajama top corresponding to the 21 ice pick holes in his wife's chest. The fabric impression on the sheet that indicated MacDonald had carried his wife's body from the bedroom of his younger daughter to the master bedroom where it was found. The analysis of fabric impressions, he said, had the same degree of scientific validity as did the identification of fingerprints. It is becoming increasingly confusing, the psychiatrist said. There is a problem in dimensions here. One is, you're dealing in a fairly precise science with what you have, and you're talking to a psychiatrist who is dealing in a fairly broad arc, not so scientific. And I'm not sure how to judge the scientific evidence that you've got here. I am terribly impressed with what you have done. But I don't know how to... All I can say is I found no serious psychiatric illness within him. Did you find any insecurity on his part, so far as his masculine role was concerned? There was an Achilles heel, let's say, in this area of masculinity or virility. But I have to find it very unlikely from a psychological standpoint that he could have committed this crime, on the basis of the information that was available to you at the time that you examined him. Yes, that's right. But it is possible that having further information made available to you, you might revise that? There are a lot of things I'd have to go through. With the new information that I now have, I would have to discuss this with him. However, as I indicated, what you are talking about is the sledgehammer to my nail file, in a sense. In the face of the overwhelming amount of scientifically oriented material that you have presented here today, I am not so sure that a psychiatrist right now is the proper person to be talking to. Well, each of the other psychiatrists and psychologists who have examined and tested him have testified before the grand jury, and they did discuss his personality traits, and I don't think there was any disagreement among any of them. They all said, in fact, that he did have an Achilles heel, his Achilles heel being his masculinity, his fear of latent homosexuality, and that having the Achilles heel, given certain special circumstances, such as fatigue, an argument about something like bedwetting, differences of opinion about how to solve the problem, Colette seeking advice from somebody other than Jeffrey concerning how to deal with this thing, such as the professor of her psychology class, and him staying awake for a long period of time, not going to bed at the same time as his wife, when he comes to bed, finally, and finds the bed wet and so on and so forth, in an ensuing argument, if Colette had said certain words, she could have triggered a violent reaction. Are you in agreement with that? Well, I would say, with that having occurred, and with his having an Achilles heel, if someone hits the Achilles heel at the wrong time, either during a time of fatigue or when he is under the influence of alcohol, I would say that it is possible he would be capable of striking a blow. And once the blow is struck, I assume that things could get out of control? They could. There could be general chaos. He could lose control, Dr. Sadoff said. Chapter 3. On January 21, 1975, Jeffrey McDonald was called back to Raleigh to testify again before the grand jury. His degree of hostility and defensiveness had intensified greatly since August, and his sarcasm and anger were in evidence almost from the start. "We have a few loose ends," Victor Warheide said. "Let's go back to April of 1970, when you went to Philadelphia and you were interviewed by a psychiatrist and interviewed and tested by a psychologist. Now, were you interviewed or tested by anyone else during this period of time?" "No," McDonald said. "Specifically, were you given a polygraph test?" "We had some discussion about it, but the answer is no." "I don't mean a polygraph test by a polygraph expert connected with the Army or connected with the government investigators, but a polygraph operator, let's say, privately retained to examine you?" "No. I'd have to discuss any more answers on that with Mr. Siegel." "I see," Warheide said. He moved on. "As you know, when you were here before, we asked you about various girls or ladies that you knew, and one of those was Penny Wells. In the course of the investigation, we have contacted some of them. There is a name I don't think we have mentioned to you. That is Laura Talbot. Do you recall her?" "No." "Well, it's going very far back, but do you remember being employed by Atlantic Construction, Inc.?" "Yes, I do." "And do you recall when that was?" "No, it was summer employment, one of my years in college, I think." "Well, specifically, do you remember it was the year of 1964? "No, I don't." "Well, do you remember where you worked in 1964? "No, I'm sure you know." Well, when I mentioned Atlantic Construction, does that refresh your recollection with respect to Laura Talbot? Yeah, I think she was a secretary working there. Oh, and tell us what happened. I bowled the girl. Big deal,